Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Earlier this week, former CIA analyst John Kiriakou was sentenced to 30 months in jail for disclosing the name of an agent who was involved in the government's torture program. In 2003, 3 years after leaving the CIA, he told ABC News about the suffocation techniques that were used during waterboarding. He said it was torture and should no longer be used by the United States, but he defended the CIA for using this technique because he believed it would prevent further attacks on the United States. He is the first CIA officer to be jailed for disclosing classified information. But what exactly is classified information? And why do the media still have trouble with that word torture? Joining us to talk about this is Kevin Gostola. He is a writer for Fire Dog Lake's The Dissenter. This is a blog covering civil liberties. He's been closely following this case along with whistleblowers in general. And Kevin joins us here in studio. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Scott Horton, contributing editor with Harper's Magazine, where he covers legal and national security issues. Hi, Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Shireen Tadros, Al Jazeera's Middle East and North Africa correspondent. She will hopefully be joining us from Tahrir Square, where thousands of people have taken to the streets calling for President Mohamed Morsi to step down. We'll be joined by Shireen in about 30 minutes. But as we always do on Friday, Kevin and Scott, we like to start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Scott, why don't we start with you? Where did you see good reporting this week?
Well, I saw some really excellent reporting coming out of the trial in Guantanamo of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And in particular, just a terrific article by Amy Davidson for The New Yorker called A Red Light at Guantanamo, in which she focuses in on the censorship system that had been set up in the courtroom and how it had been used in a way that confounded all the lawyers, including the judge, not just the reporters who were trying to cover it. It turns out that somebody outside of the courtroom, someone clearly being the CIA, was censoring what could be heard and reported about the case without any involvement from the judge. The judge grew furious over this, and she writes it up, I think, in a way that demonstrates how what looks like a small technical glitch is actually something quite profound that raises very serious questions about the entirety of the proceedings.
What questions does this raise for you?
The major question it raises is of the independence of the court process, because there quite literally is somebody outside of the room steering what's going on there. And it looks like the government doesn't want to take any chances about what might happen in this case and is not allowing the judge to play the role that the law prescribes for him.
Well, and I'm glad you brought this up, because just a couple of weeks ago marked the 11th anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo. It really didn't get that much attention if you're just looking at headlines. And then we also just got news earlier this week, I believe, on Monday, right? The State Department reassigned Daniel Freed, the special envoy for closing Guantanamo, and will not replace him. So this office is being shut down. How significant is this, Scott?
Well, I think it points to something that's an embarrassment for President Obama. You know, he made his pledge to shut down Guantanamo during his first term. He was unable to do that. And during the last election campaign, he repeated it. He said it remained his objective. But we really don't see any evidence of him moving to accomplish it. So this is one of these rare, very clear-cut cases where he made a promise that can be measured very clearly, and he's not coming through on it.
Kevin, what are your thoughts on that? And what about media coverage of Guantanamo?
I think that it has been appalling, because what can be communicated is that there are 86 people that are confined and being held in indefinite detention at Guantanamo right now. They have been cleared for release, and this was done by a review authorized by Barack Obama, but yet essentially they were given hope, and then that hope was ripped away from them, because there is no you can't look on the horizon and see that there's going to be this possibility that many of these people are returned to their countries.
So based on the closure of this office, is Guantanamo going to be open indefinitely?
It certainly looks like that.
Wow. All right. Well, we're going to have to follow this and possibly do a show because that angle is not really being reported. So thank you for that, Scott. Kudos again to Amy Davidson at The New Yorker for her piece on Guantanamo. And what about you, Kevin? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, it's more of a piece of a project, but I want to point out what the people at muckrock.com or Muckrock News have been doing by having individuals submit Freedom of Information Act requests for records on the police departments across the United States that are obtaining drones for use for surveillance and been tracking whether the FAA has actually authorized these agencies to have the drones, whether, you know, they're getting details on how they plan to use them. The post that's up today on Muckrock happens to talk about a Dragonflyer drone that would be used for search and rescue operations or even active shooter situations, which is a bit troubling to me when I consider what that could mean. So I want to point them out because I think they're doing important work, and it's a crowdsourced project. They basically asked anyone from around the United States to submit a Freedom of Information Act request to get the records, and then they've been blogging about them for the last year.
Interesting. And so what is the status of these FOIA requests?
Well, they seem to have gotten quite a few, and they're moving on to, I think they've gotten hundreds, and they're moving on to do another year in 2013. They're calling it a drone census. So it's a way to just track the what the police departments are doing with this new technology, because the FAA is not being forthright and they're very secretive about what they're doing in the way of developing rules around the drones.
And how significant do you think is the UN's announcement to begin officially studying and looking at the effects of drones?
It's certainly significant because if you look at the announcement, it is clear that this UN Special Rapporteur does not believe that the drone program follows international law. He reads about how actually United States is completely isolated in its belief that it is following the international law.
And Scott, what are your thoughts about the methods this website is using, asking people to file FOIA requests to get information about drones?
Well, brilliant. And I think they're having some success with it. I think this points to a whole different dimension of the drone program. We're used to looking at what goes on in Somalia and Pakistan. But the manufacturers are making this full throttle effort to peddle them to law enforcement agencies in the United States. And in fact, I looked in at one effort that was going on here in New York where they were trying to sell them to the state highway patrol, basically saying you can catch every single person the instant they hit 56 miles an hour with overhead drains. You can quadruple your revenue from traffic tickets. And this is going on all over the country right now. And I think people may not be chilled by what happens in the Northwest Frontier Province in Pakistan, but they might very well be chilled by that. I'd also say what's going on in the UN is a very, very important. Ben Emmerson's report, which I've been tracking very closely, he's right on the money. He says the U.S. is isolated. And in fact, I attended a NATO Defense College function last summer at this, where inside of NATO, there was not one single other country willing to adopt the U.S. view of the use of drones. None. That's amongst our allies. Mm. So we're really striking out completely in the hyper-aggressive posture that the Obama administration is taking on this.
And Ben Emmerson, he's the UN Special Rapporteur who's going to be heading this study?
Exactly.
And Scott, since you follow this closely, what are your thoughts on media coverage of drones? If citizens are filing FOIA requests to get this kind of information, why aren't we seeing more journalists do this?
Well, I think there hasn't really been enough coverage, and there hasn't been enough coverage that shows the full spectrum of issues that arise with it. The coverage that comes out right now is heavily dictated by what goes on inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C. How people choose to frame and present it as an issue is what we see. So we haven't really seen the broader context of it, and that's a problem. And I think, you know, that's a consistent problem with national security and intelligence reporting in the United States, which is that the, you know, the intelligence community and national security community really dictate what are the issues and how they're going to be presented and discussed. There's not enough independent or critical writing about it.
Have you both seen major changes under the Obama administration when it comes to FOIA requests and how that information is handed over to citizens and journalists? Scott, have you seen major changes?
Well, I'll tell you, the Obama campaign in 2008, he set out a very clear policy about FOIAs in which he pointed to things that have been done incorrectly by the Bush administration and wrongfully withholding information. He promised to change that, and I've been tracking the way he's been performing, and frankly, I see no change. I mean, I see he has proceeded with the same sort of hyper-aggressive denial of FOIA requests that we saw under Bush. If anything, it's actually gotten worse.
Wow. Kevin, what are your thoughts on that, and why doesn't this get more play? Because he did say he's going to run the most open government we've ever seen.
Yeah, and I think it's actually been, if not as bad as Bush, it's been a bit worse. In fact, the Washington Post was tracking annual reports and found that media organizations and individuals requesting information under FOIA were less likely to receive the material than in 2010 at 10 of the 15 cabinet-level departments. So it's actually getting difficult for people to get information. And I just would add one quick note to the drones thing, which is that I found in my watching and viewing of this Rise of the Drones program last week that in the front end, it said that Lockheed Martin had provided additional funding, and that whether it is true that they actually gave money for the production of the program, on its face appeared to be a conflict of interest, which was something that I pointed out. And the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting has now been sending complaints to the ombudsman, and he received over 500 as a result, because this is something we have to be really concerned about, the fact that coverage of this drone program is going to be influenced by the military defense industry.
That is Kevin Gostola. He is a writer for Fire Dog Lakes, The Dissenter. This is a blog covering civil liberties. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. He covers legal and national security issues. And you can find their reporting at yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you. We're going to be talking about the Obama administration going after whistleblowers. We'll also discuss coverage of former CIA analyst John Kiriakou. He was sentenced to 30 months in prison for exposing information on the CIA's torture program. This received extensive media coverage this week. We're looking at headlines from Al Jazeera, Politico, NBC, The New York Times, Fox, CBS, you name it. They have all covered this. So what are your thoughts about how the media cover these issues and specifically talk about torture? It seems like they're still afraid to use that word. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Later in the show, we'll hopefully be joined by Shireen Tadros. She'll join us from Tahrir Square in Egypt, where thousands of people are taking to the streets. And if something struck you in the media this week, if you'd like to give kudos to a journalist or maybe criticize a story, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email it to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post it to our website, yourcallradio.org. So let's talk about former CIA analyst John Kiriakou, who was sentenced to 30 months in prison for exposing information on the CIA's torture program. Kevin, first off, you've been following this very closely. Give us a little background here.
Yes, and I've had the ability, I've met Kiriakou multiple times now and also spoke to him, and what he's described in his background is just essentially that he came up, you know, through the agency, had worked as a CIA officer. One thing that's come up is being involved in the operation that ended up capturing Abu Zubaydah. What he's told me, and I think this will get to where there's been some complexity in the way that his case has been approached by people, that what he's shared with me is this evolution around torture, because initially he decided that he did not want to be trained in the interrogation techniques or the torture techniques, and he was morally opposed to doing that to people. But he was told by the CIA, this is what he communicated to me, he was told by the CIA that they were able to get some information out of Abu Zubaydah. And later on, when he read the 2009 Inspector General report, it was clear that this was covering up the fact that they had completely abused and tortured Abu Zubaydah, and that there wasn't any intelligence that was valuable. And then that's when he says he became an unapologetic opponent, no matter what, just believing it's unethical and immoral.
And he served with the CIA from 1990 to 2004. Okay, so then what happened? So he goes out into the media and talks about how... Now, did he... This is what I'm unclear about. Did he actually oppose torture, period? Or does he just oppose it in some circumstances?
That's why I use the word evolution, because in 2007, and even he admits this, he had gone on MSNBC and other programs and had said it can work at some times, but that he was opposed to it himself. I mean, he was essentially saying that the thing that makes the CIA upset is that he goes on TV and says it's an official U.S. policy, and there aren't it's not just rogue CIA officers. It's not just a few bad apples. And that's something that the agency ends up having to grapple with. And what becomes clear is if you track the way that there are all these extra legal measures that are taken against him, then you see that he became a target after he started to publish op-eds and after he started to go on the media.
So who made this decision to go after him?
It appears it would be some individuals inside the CIA from the top ranks of the agency nudging the Justice Department constantly to put together some kind of a case with some charges. And if we go quickly through some of the harassment he's endured in the last 4 years, he was audited every year by the IRS since 2007. His wife was harassed by the Office of Security and eventually forced out of her job. She had to go get another job now. Of course, his career is over. He has FBI agents that have been following him and continue to following him to get groceries. And he has 5 children following him to school, even sitting in church in the pews watching him. He could see. And just basically this intimidation, this looking over his shoulder constantly because they didn't want him to go to trial. This is one of the ways that the Justice Department tries to destroy you and force you to plea out. So he faced up to 35 years in prison and was charged under the Espionage Act and had many other charges he was facing. And this is, you know, the real possibility was that he would be in jail until he died and wouldn't see his kids again. And so he pled out to 30 months and took that deal because he had the security of knowing he would see his family again.
Scott, why do you think the government went after Kiriakou?
And well, yeah, I'd say it's something quite specific here. I mean, when he disclosed the policy surrounding torture, he also disclosed the exact chain of decision making concerning the policies that showed how the proposal would be made. It would go up the ladder within operations, then to the office of the director, general counsel, and the CIA. Then there would be a formal consultation with the Department of Justice, which would sign off on it. Then it would go to the National Security Council and the White House for approval at the White House level. So he made clear that, you know, I mean, not only was this a matter of formal policy, but that the decisions to actually torture were being made using people all the way up the chain of command, effectively, in Washington, D.C., with the Justice Department smack in the middle of it, actually. The impetus here to go after him, to build a case against him, clearly came out of the CIA, and it clearly came specifically from people who were involved and were embarrassed by the disclosures that he made. I think there's just nothing controversial about that. That's clear. John Rizzo, who was acting general counsel during most of this period, has acknowledged this in public events, that they made the call, they made the decision. And that's horrendous. That's not the way our our law enforcement process is supposed to work. You know, professional federal prosecutors acting with independent judgment are supposed to make these decisions.
Why do you think this case particularly is getting so much media attention? And what do you think of the coverage?
Well, I think the bottom line in this case is that this is the outcome of the torture program within the CIA. We have complete official impunity for all the people who used torture, including those who literally tortured people to death, because we have two cases where CIA agents used torture techniques and people in their custody died, and there's no question of direct relationship between the death and the use of the techniques. No action on any of those cases, but a CIA agent who decided to come clean and talk about it is prosecuted. So, I mean, that's just an absolutely shocking situation where the prosecutors have an absolute obligation under international law to bring charges. They haven't done it, and instead they use the power of prosecution as an act of intimidation to harass and silence effectively people within the intelligence community who would talk about this. It's, totally shocking. I think the quality of coverage of this issue has been spotty up and down, but I think there definitely is some very solid coverage out there. I mean, I think Scott Shane's major piece in the New York Times is super, and there are a number of other journalists who've done a very, very good job of evaluating the facts and piecing it all together. And I'd say in none of the major accounts does the Department of Justice come out or the Intelligence Committee emerge looking very good. In fact, I'd say they look sleazy.
Well, and it, I mean, it did get so much attention. It's interesting also to look at the headlines and to see when the word torture is used or not. Kevin, it seems like when a case like this comes up, the media really have two opportunities here. You can look at the Obama administration's record on going after whistleblowers, and then to really have another conversation about torture.
Yes, you can talk about both of those issues, and there are remarkable stories that you can tell around the fact that the people who have tortured, as Scott was rightfully saying, the people who have tortured have not been held accountable, but yet you have people like Jose Rodriguez, who was involved in the destruction of torture tapes, of destroying that evidence, who can go on tour and talk about his book, Hard Measures, and how he supports torture and how it was effective. And he can do these events around Zero Dark 30, even this film that places torture in a context to where it looks like something people should be supportive of. And he can do these events with former CIA director Michael Hayden and can just basically have his way with the media. And yet someone like John, because I think what we have to get back to is this reality of this being more about the person with the message than the fact that he released some kind of some person's name. And one particular instance that I want to make sure I say on air here is that he was set up by the FBI in the summer of 2010, that he was approached by a foreign intelligence officer, a quote-unquote foreign intelligence officer, who claimed to want him to sell classified information. And it turned out that this happened to be an FBI agent and that they were trying to set him up on an Espionage Act charge. And the only reason why he was able to not be entrapped is because he was documenting his communication and he kept telling the FBI that he was trying to have this meeting. So I think you have to look at the way that they're coming after him to realize that the charges are just, this is what they have to do to nail him. It's, if they could do it another way, they would.
That is Kevin Gostola, writer with Firedog Lakes, The Dissenter, a blog covering civil liberties, talking about former CIA analyst John Kiriakou, who was just sentenced to 30 months in jail for disclosing the name of an agent who is involved in the government's torture program. We're also joined by Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, where he covers legal and national security issues. After the break, we'll talk about the media's coverage of torture. We'd also love to hear from you. What stood out for you in the news this week? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Mr. stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org, and they're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. And you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or send an email, question, or comment to feedback at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about the state of mental health. According to the National Alliance on Mental Health, 58 million Americans experience a mental health disorder in a given year, but only 30% receive mental health services. This is getting some attention in wake of the recent shootings, but people who are involved in this say that it deserves a lot more. State budgets have been slammed on mental health services, and a lot of states are now rethinking these ongoing budget cuts. That's on Monday. And then Tuesday, we will talk about how automation is replacing people on the job market. How concerned should we be about that? And what's to come in the coming years? If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us today, what are your thoughts on how the media really cover whistleblowers? We talked about Aaron Schwartz last week, and we'll talk with Scott about that because he's been writing about Aaron Schwartz. And if you saw a story this week that stood out for you, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We're joined today by Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, where he covers legal and national security issues. Kevin Gostola is a writer for Fire Dog Lakes, The Dissenter, a blog covering civil liberties. And before we talk about those two, I just want to take a few calls and hear from listeners with stories they'd like to talk about. Let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a very good program.
Thank you.
I just finished reading an interesting article that appeared yesterday in Jeune Afrique, which is a French magazine published in France, whose focus is Africa, North Africa. It's about the huge impact of the attack on that gas plant in the south of Algeria. The name of the plant is In Amenas, and the Algerians compare it to really what happened to the U.S. with 9/11. And the impact on the economy of Algeria is huge. The plant processes approximately 18% of Algeria's oil and gas exports, 18%. Of course, they've had to shut it down. And the revenues from that plant amount to $1 billion a month. It's absolutely huge. And in addition, they're very unhappy with the way this thing was covered in the international media, particularly critical of Al Jazeera and also the Mauritanian outlet called ANI. Because they feel that they had access to Mokhtar Belmokhtar, the head of the group that attacked the facility, and that he was given equal standing to the Algerian authorities that were doing their best, really dealing with a huge crisis that takes them back to the years of the civil war in Algeria. But fascinating article. I didn't realize that the economic impact was that big. It's very big. Of course, they've had to shut down the facility, And it's going to take them a while to recondition it, repair it, and get it going again. I'll stop here and take your comments off the air.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Max. I have not been following this, but for listeners that don't know, an Algerian gas facility was attacked on January 16th. According to reports, it's set to reopen within a month, but foreign workers will not return for another year. Scott or Kevin, have you been following this at all?
I have, and I know the account in Jeune Afrique that Max is referring to as well. I mean, you know, I think this is, to its great misfortune, I think, West Africa is now coming to center stage in the world play on national security issues. We've got the war in Mali, and we have this incident in Algeria, and of course these things are directly connected. And I think, of course, there was a lot of concerns about the way the media coverage unfolded. But I would add to the things that Max noted, that there was a lot of concern about the way Algeria reported on it, because it really put in place a news embargo that made it very, very difficult for people to be informed about what was happening either in real time or in a matter of several hours later. Now, I can understand for operational security reasons why they might have wanted to do that, but that was very frustrating to reporters trying to cover it. On the other hand, I think he makes a major point. There is this agency in Mauritania that had direct ties to Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, and to their leader, and there was a lot of reporting that was just putting them side by side, that is, Al-Qaeda and the Algerians, as adversaries, and that strikes me as a fundamentally flawed approach to reporting.
All right, well, thank you again for calling in, Max, and we'll put links about this on our website, yourcallradio.org. And I also, Scott, wanted to get your view, since you cover torture and you've covered it for so long. What are your thoughts on the media's coverage of torture in early 2013? A recent study by Rethink Media looked at the coverage of 50 media outlets between October 2010 and October 2012. The study found there was only one period of time between those 2 years when the 50 outlets used the term torture more than some other phrase. And it seems like some media outlets are still hesitant to use that term. Would you agree? And if so, why is that?
I think these studies are very, very clear. And in fact, it reaches all the way through in American media. I mean, you know, our national publications like the Washington Post and New York Times are some of the worst performers in this area, but it's certainly true of all of our broadcast media. And you can look at the exact same conduct, and if it's being done by agents of the U.S. government, it will never be described as torture. But if it's being done by another government, North Korea, China, or others, then it is torture. So there's this failure to call things by proper names. And what is the consequence of this? I mean, if we look at public opinion polling over the last 10 years, we're seeing a steady drift now. This drift has continued all the way through the Obama presidency of more and more Americans being prepared to accept torture, even when it's labeled as torture, and even higher numbers when it's not, as something that the U.S. government should reach to as part of its national security arsenal. And why is that? Because I think the media offers a big stage for the defenders, and we see, like Jose Rodriguez, General Hayden, and others out there constantly beating the drums for this. And there's really no response to it on the public stage. That is, because the Obama administration would be the side that should be responding, and they're not. They basically keep silence on the issue. And you see very, very little interviews or discussions from other authoritative figures like church leaders, for instance, who are quite unequivocal in their positions, but that does not get picked up and reported in the American media.
And then when you have people like President Obama and outgoing Secretary of State Hillary Clinton sit down for a side-by-side interview on 60 Minutes, these questions don't come up.
Yeah, only very in the broadest sense. So they both talked about the reputational damage that the country had faced under the Bush administration, but there was no attention to the detail of how that damage came about, what it was that United States had done that had so tarnished its reputation.
Kevin, what would you add to that?
I would say that we're hitting a critical area here where most of the emphasis has been on the image of the United States and how people now see the country as one that engages in torture. If you look at history and you can look at government records, you see that this isn't the first time that the United States was torturing people in this war on terrorism, as it was called by the Bush administration. You can go back to previous wars. But I think it's important, these studies, the Harvard did a study in back in 2008 that or looking at the period from 2000 to 2008 and found that in the 1930s to 2004 you had newspapers that were calling the practice torture, that the New York Times characterized it 81% of the times as torture, the Los Angeles Times 96%. But if you went forward and you looked from 2002 to 2008, you essentially had only 1.4% of the times for the New York Times, and then you had 4.8% for the Los Angeles Times, and then they even looked at the Wall Street Journal and found that that was around a 1%, 1.5%. So it just it went down, and now exactly what Scott said, that if other countries do it, it's called torture, but if we do it, then it is not, and that is the fact of the way it's been covered.
That is Kevin Gostola. He is a writer for Fire Dog Lakes, The Dissenter, a blog covering civil liberties. Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, where he covers legal and national security issues. And you can join us at 866-798-8255 if you'd like to weigh in on the media's coverage of the issues we're discussing, or if there was a story out there that really stood out for you. If you liked it or maybe didn't like it, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And sticking with questions about how the media cover the federal government, you know, going after whistleblowers or people like Aaron Swartz. Scott, you wrote a piece on the 14th called Aaron Swartz, RIP, and it says a leading cyber activist commits suicide at 26. Was he hounded to death by federal prosecutors? And I wonder when these stories, the devastating story in this case happens, it gets so much attention for a week and then it tends to die down. Places like Wired will do follow-ups, but it's rare that you see that in the national media. What are your thoughts on this? And what responsibility do reporters have to continue asking hard questions about someone like Aaron Swartz who committed suicide?
Well, I think this is an excellent example of how media coverage is basically distorted and controlled by the Justice Department on criminal matters. Because if you go back and you look at the reporting about Swartz, I mean, you can see some friendly pieces appearing in social media and in blog spaces, but newspapers, magazines, this is heavily driven by official statements that are issued by the Department of Justice, which were making claims and charges that were over the top and completely ridiculous, couldn't be backed up by any facts. So the reporting out there was grossly distorted, and I think this is one of the things that helped drive this young man, this brilliant young man, to his death. Mm. You know, one of the questions here is, and I think within prosecutorial circles, this is just viewed as the way things are done. You know, we want to, you know, strike a blow for public interest. And one of the ways we'll do that is we will use the media very, very aggressively to go after our adversaries, and they do. And whereas defense media tends to be very, very quiet. And one of the questions here is this all going to die out now, or will there be continued attention paid to it? And I think I really see signs now that in Congress, across the aisle, both among Republicans and Democrats, there's a sense that the Justice Department, that the prosecutor in Boston, Carmen Ortiz, did something truly reprehensible in this case. And there has to be some accountability for it. So I think we're going to see hearings in Congress about it. And you know, if you look at, you know, four or five leading members of Congress who have been pressing the issue, they span the complete political spectrum. It's John Cornyn, very conservative Republican, Daryl Issa, a firebrand right Republican from California, and moderate and liberal Democrats, all sending letters to the Justice Department saying, what you're claiming in this case doesn't stand up. This looks horrendous. You better explain yourself. And we want you to do it on the record before a hearing. So I think, you know, this is a case of grossly mistaken judgment, and there's been no atonement for it yet coming out of the Justice Department. I think it's time for Congress to press for that.
And you can find Scott Horton's piece, Carmen Ortiz Strikes Out, at yourcallradio.org, contributing editor for Harper's Magazine. And we were just able to connect with Shireen Tadros, so I'd like to go to Shireen now. She is Al Jazeera's Middle East and North Africa correspondent, and Shireen is joining us from Tahrir Square in Cairo, Egypt. Hi, Shireen. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
So I know you can stay with us for just a couple minutes. Paint us a picture. What are you seeing on the streets right now? Give us the latest.
Well, let me tell you exactly where I am. I'm actually not in the square. I am at the presidential palace, and that is the area now, which is basically looks like a battle zone. A few hours ago, a group of protesters went right up to the walls of the presidential palace, and they started throwing firebombs, Molotov cocktails over the wall. Now, the police at the beginning were responding just using water cannons, throwing stones at the protesters, but then very quickly the situation escalated, and in the last hour or so, we've seen hundreds of security force officers deployed all the way down the street in front of the presidential palace using tear gas to disperse the crowd. One shot of tear gas after the next has basically been constant in the last hour so that I've been standing out here. Meanwhile, more people are joining, those who were in Tahrir Square for the original protest, are coming here in solidarity with the demonstrators. And the chants are very much like we were hearing during the uprising 2 years ago. People demanding now that Mohamed Morsi, the president, step down.
And how big is this protest, Shireen? The opposition said this is going to be a peaceful protest.
That's right. There are a few hundred people here, and the political opposition has actually called on their supporters to leave, saying that this isn't the way forward, that we won't achieve anything by attacking the presidential palace. Now, we've heard some very strong warnings in the last half hour or so by the presidency and the government, who have said that they will deal with as much force as necessary to protect public institutions, especially the palace. Mohamed Morsi, the president, isn't inside the palace. This isn't where he lives. This is where he works. But it's extremely significant, of course, place. And once again, the where protesters have decided to come to voice their extreme frustration and anger with the president.
What role is the military playing here?
Right now, none. Not in this area. There are some Republican guards, I've heard, that are in the area. I haven't seen them myself. It's more likely that they're inside the walls of the presidential palace. But in terms of actual army, there is no army in the area. They have not been deployed to this particular place.
And just over the past week, over 50 people have been killed. Since the revolution began, over 1,000 have been killed. No one has been held responsible. What are you hearing from the people on the streets, Shireen? What message are they trying to get out?
You know, this is what's very interesting about this latest round of violence. And, you know, Egypt's been subject over the course of the 2 years to several rounds. But really, this is very much an explosion, if you like, of real frustration that has its roots in the economy at the end of the day, an economy that's on the brink of collapse, that people are feeling the pinch every day. Already around 40% of the population were living below the poverty line. So when prices rise, like the price of gasoline, the price of bread, the price of rice, as has been happening, especially over the last few months, people feel not only disappointed that the revolution didn't help them in their daily lives, but that the revolution actually had harmed them. So there's deep frustration over the fact that there's been so little change, that in terms of the economy, things have got worse. And that's really the frustration that we're seeing boiling over into violence on the street.
And Shireen, last question. How widespread is dissatisfaction with the government and President Morsi?
All I've heard in the past few hours I've been standing out here is he is illegitimate, he must go. I mean, increasingly, the calls are not for example, the Constitution to be amended, or for various sort of freedoms and social justice. Increasingly, the call on the street, whether that's in Cairo or the other provinces, is for Mohamed Morsi to step down. You know, the question is always, how big is that call? How many people actually support that? Right now, it's not a significant amount of the population. I mean, it looks very bad here. It's pretty chaotic. But I think most people in the country just want stability. They want to go back to normal. They want an end to this sort of cycle of violence. So really, there is deep frustration, certainly at the government and the presidency. But I do think that they will ride this wave out of demonstrations.
All right. Well, Shireen, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
Thank you, and stay safe. That's Shireen Tadros. She is Al Jazeera English's Middle East and North Africa correspondent, joining us from the presidential palace in Cairo, Egypt. According to her latest report, the inevitability of more violence and more people being killed is a depressing reality. And just to give you some context, earlier this week, President Morsi declared a state of emergency which allows police to arrest and detain protesters for 30 days without charge. The value of the Egyptian currency has plummeted to new lows. As she said, 40% of the people are living below the poverty line. She reports that the poor foundation of the state laid down after the revolution means every few weeks there is a partial collapse. Nothing is fixed, just plastered over. And we will continue following this story. And Scott, you know, when you look at the nomination of John Kerry as the new Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton's last day is today. You know, a lot of people are just wondering what does this mean for U.S. foreign policy, specifically when we're talking about Egypt and the Middle East? Do you expect any changes with someone like John Kerry?
I don't expect to see changes in an approach or doctrine. I think there'll be some changes in style. But I think, you know, certainly Egypt is likely to figure in the next 4 years as a major engagement point for the United States. I mean, this is a country that has historically been a country that has had very, very tight relations with the U.S., that has been one of the two largest recipients of U.S. aid for decades now, and we now have a government that is, you know, hostile might be too strong, but I mean certainly, certainly critical of the United States in a way that the U.S. hasn't experienced for decades, and I think it's going to require a lot of diplomacy to find a way of living with this government and continuing a positive relationship.
And the Obama administration has been very mild in their criticism of Morsi.
I think necessarily so. I mean, I think they're waiting to see how things play out there. And I think there's a broad sense in the U.S. that, you know, all the cards haven't been played yet. And we don't know whether Morsi will succeed in stabilizing his position in the country and establishing a stable long-term government. You know, there are just many other factors at play there. And I think the U.S. right now doesn't want to unnecessarily antagonize anyone.
And what about, we briefly touched on this last week, what about the media's coverage as we are seeing transitions in power? And, you know, you've got major politicians asking Chuck Hagel and John Kerry questions. And it's a really good time, we thought, last week, although we didn't really see much of it, for the media to say, okay, what is the United States foreign policy record? It just seems like now is a good time to really explore these issues. What are your thoughts on that, Scott?
Well, I'd say, you know, Egypt is a great example for that question because, you know, the U.S. Foreign affairs community and foreign affairs coverage, when it deals with the Middle East, it tends inflexibly to ask questions about Israel and whether Israel's interest in that is Israel played. There tends to be actually very little expertise brought to bear that shows domestic understanding of the situation in Egypt, and that continues to be the case. And I think we saw that in the hearings, in the Hagel hearings yesterday, which I thought were almost farcical. I mean, those hearings turned out to be a question of the Iraq war and outrage on the part of Republicans over the fact that he was prepared to be critical of the Iraq war, sort of a sense that he's a heretic.
Yeah.
And he needs to be removed. Whereas his answers and his own positions were like a bowl of polenta. They were so bland, so unsurprising, and so uncontroversial.
Well, and also, they really spent so much time focusing on his criticism of Israel and the Israeli lobby in the United States.
That's right. I mean, he had used that phrase, the Jewish lobby, at one point, and I lost count of the number of times he apologized for having said that.
Right.
And of course, you know, they put him in this impossible position of, you know, tell us who was intimidated by these people. Well, you know, if he said someone was intimidated by him, he would alienate that senator. Of course, it was an impossible question to answer. In a sense, it was also sort of ridiculous. I mean, everybody understands that AIPAC is a very, very powerful force within Washington. It's proud of the muscle it flexes, and it has tremendous influence on Middle East policy. And Frank, maybe the hearings with Hagel are a good demonstration of that.
Well, and also, I mean, when you've got senators asking these questions. How do you think the media should deal with it? Because you would think, well, maybe a reporter would step back and say, hey, this is, gives us a good opportunity to really look at AIPAC and to see how powerful this really is. Instead, I just keep hearing, I think it's Lindsey Graham, right? I keep hearing his question over and over again on the radio. Kevin, what are your thoughts? How should the media deal with hearings like this?
I think they definitely have a responsibility to rise, to take what's being said and extract it from the farce, because otherwise you don't understand what's going on here. The other thing that was just, I think, pretty hysterical was the fact that this became all about whether or not we would have nuclear weapon disarmament. I mean, the one of the things that was confounding to me is just to realize how many of these senators want to keep nuclear weapons, and I bet if you ask them, would even suggest that you increase the amount of nuclear weapons that the United States has. And at the same time, you know, their fixation on Iran getting a nuclear weapon, the complete hypocrisy of what you see publicly and the world. I can't imagine what everyone all over in different countries are thinking as they see this. And the real issue is this culture of Hegel having these positions that are somewhat taboo to the establishment and then trying to get in, sacrificing everything that he has in terms of conscience and integrity in order to cower before these senators to get a position as the Secretary of Defense, and understanding that he's willing to give up those things that make him somewhat of a good candidate for Pentagon chief.
Well, we've got about a minute left, and I'm just wondering what you both are working on right now. Kevin, what are you working on?
I'm going to continue to track the Bradley Manning proceedings. Also expect to follow what's going on next week in New York City with the appeal in the case of the indefinite detention provision in the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012. This is a major proceeding that's going to happen. I'm hearing that it's going to be quite a gathering of whistleblowers and transparency advocates and activists who are going to continue to challenge. McCain apparently is going to be submitting some testimony in favor of keeping the indefinite detention provision. So this is what I'm going to keep following and continuing to following any whistleblowing stories related to Kiriakou.
And that's Kevin Gostola, a writer with Firedog Lakes, the Dissenter. And Scott, what about you? Just quickly, what are you working on?
I'll have up in just a matter of a few hours an interview with director Alex Gibney about his new documentary, Mea Maxima Culpa, which will premiere on Monday evening on HBO. It's about the child abuse scandal within the Catholic Church.
Oh, wow.
It's a spectacular piece.
Oh, wow. Great. Thank you so much. We'll look for that. Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. Scott and Kevin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What's the state of mental health today? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about mental illnesses. According to the National Alliance on Mental Health, approximately 58 million Americans experience a mental health disorder in a given year, but only 30% receive services. So what is mental illness? What can be done to erase the stigma? And what resources are available for helping people with mental disorders? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihei Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.